This is Audible.
Random House Audiobooks presents Eating Well for Optimum Health by Dr. Andrew Weil, read for you by the author.
Eating Well for Optimum Health, The Essential Guide to Food, Diet, and Nutrition by Andrew Weil, MD. In the course of my work, questions always come up about food and nutrition, diet and health. It is not always easy to find answers to these questions, especially today when we are bombarded by so much confusing and contradictory nutritional information. My purpose in presenting this program is to cut through the confusion. I have always been interested in food, enjoy eating, and have studied the dietary habits of many different cultures around the world, especially to note correlations with patterns of health and illness. As a result of what I have learned, I use dietary change as a primary treatment in my medical practice, and I teach other physicians to do the same. Throughout my lifetime, I have read many words of medical thinking as to what's good for us and what isn't. Not long ago, I read that olive oil was bad for cardiovascular health. Now I see that it is good. I have seen fad diets come and go, and then sometimes come again and go again. As I speak, low-carbohydrate diets are enjoying a huge wave of popularity. I have serious reservations about them for long-term use, but I don't want to get ahead of myself. I will explain the dangers of those diets in due course. I never want to promise anything I can't deliver, whether in my personal life, in my medical practice, or in this program. I will not make extravagant promises in this program, not of endless life nor of miracle cures, though diet and nutrition can play a significant role in what I have referred to elsewhere as spontaneous healing. Here is what I can promise you in this program. I will provide for you all the basic facts of human nutrition. I will equip you with the essential information that will allow you to make informed decisions about weight reduction and diet aids. I will help you to be able to read labels on all food products, which will allow you to be a far wiser consumer. I will discuss a number of popular diets, their pros and cons, and recommend my own diet for optimum health. It is my sincere belief that if you adhere to the guidelines I have established here, you will be the better for it, as will your children, both in the near future and in the years ahead. And just as important as any fact I will demonstrate to you, I want you to emerge from this program clearly convinced that eating for health and eating for pleasure are not incompatible, that it is possible to eat in ways that best serve your body while also getting all the enjoyment you expect from food. A healthy diet is the cornerstone of a healthy lifestyle. You will find in this program all the information you need to put that cornerstone in place. When I use the words eating well, I mean using food not only to influence health and well-being, but to satisfy the senses, providing pleasure and comfort. In addition to supplying the basic needs of the body for calories and nutrients, an optimum diet should also reduce risks of disease and fortify the body's defenses and intrinsic mechanisms of healing. I believe that how we eat is an important determinant of how we feel and how we age. I also believe that food can function as medicine to influence a variety of common ailments. The American Council on Science and Health, a New York-based nonprofit organization dedicated to helping distinguish between real and hypothetical health risks, recently suggested 10 resolutions for a healthy New Year. The council included obvious ones such as don't smoke, wear seat belts, and install smoke detectors, but addressed diet in only one paragraph. Eat a balanced and varied diet. Avoid obesity and fad diets. There are no magical guidelines for good nutrition. Patients should resolve to plan their diet around the watchwords variety, moderation, and balance. Remember, there are no good or bad foods. The primary danger from food is overindulgence. I find this advice to be remarkably unhelpful. Eat a balanced diet? What is that? I meet people who think that adding a salad with creamy dressing to a cheeseburger and french fries balances the meal. Avoid obesity? Sure, that sounds like a good idea, but how do you do it? There are no good or bad foods. What about soybeans? They contain healthy fiber, a fat that may help lower cholesterol, and unusual compounds called isoflavones that may offer significant protection against common forms of cancer. Soybeans seem like a good food to me. What about margarine? For years, I've been telling my patients to avoid it because it contains trans fatty acids, TFAs, unnatural fats that promote inflammation, heart disease, and cancer. Sounds like a bad food to me. I won't eat it, even in moderation or in the pursuit of variety. The primary danger from food is overindulgence? I'm sure my distant ancestors had no problem in that area, but what am I supposed to do when everywhere I look I see tempting offerings of food in ever more novel preparations, when many restaurants score points for the size of portions they serve, when I get more for my money buying giant sizes of food and drink, and when people who love me or want my attention give me food and more food as expressions of their affection or interest? The poor advice about diet and health that people get far too often when they ask physicians, nurses, registered dietitians, and other representatives of the healthcare establishment for help reflects the dearth of good nutritional education in our professional schools. If you look to other sources, alternative practitioners, bookstores, health food stores, the internet, for example, there is no shortage of information about nutritional influences on health. In fact, there is much too much of it out there, most of it contradictory, unscientific, and intended to promote particular foods, diets, or dietary supplements. At one extreme are authorities telling us that we are what we eat, that health, good and bad, is entirely or mostly a creation of what we put in our mouths. There is a kernel of attractive logic in that formulation that resonates with common sense. We have to eat to live because food is fuel for the metabolic engine. The quality of fuel you burn must influence your body, just as the grade of fuel you put into an internal combustion engine influences its performance for better or worse, not only in the short run, a smooth purr versus a ragged knock, for example, but also in the long run, retarding or accelerating the accumulation of deposits that reduce the longevity of valves, rings, and ultimately the engine itself. But it is a long way from this simple observation to the conclusion that diet is everything. At the other extreme, our voice is telling us it doesn't matter. Eat healthy, exercise, die anyway. My Uncle Jake ate big helpings of bacon, eggs, steak, and butter every day of his life and lived to be 99. People who say you can affect your health and treat disease by changing your diet are food faddists. It's all in your genes anyway. My purpose in creating this program is to explore the issues and controversies surrounding food and nutrition in order to bring clarity to the subject and establish for listeners a sense of what eating well means. First, I want to state 7 basic propositions that underlie my philosophy of food and nutrition and their influence on health. First, we have to eat to live. The body requires energy for all of its functions, from the beating of the heart and the elimination of wastes, to the transmission of electrical and chemical signals in the nervous system. It gets its energy from food, by taking it in, digesting it, and metabolizing its components. Food is fuel that contains energy from the sun, originally captured and stored by green plants, then passed along to fruits, seeds, and animals. Humans eat these foods and burn the fuel they contain, that is, combine it with oxygen in a controlled fashion to release and capture the stored solar energy. As long as we live, we have to eat and eat often. Or do we? Throughout history, there have been unsubstantiated reports of persons who survive without eating. Their ability to do so is usually ascribed to sainthood or to mastery of esoteric mental powers. I can understand that some people are fascinated by the possibility of surviving without eating because of a philosophical quandary, the fact that we live at the expense of other life. Whether we destroy carrots or cows, it is a fact that we are unable to survive and grow without ending the existence of other life forms. Nature, red in tooth and claw, includes us. Green plants, of course, are not burdened with this requirement. They eat light, binding the energy of photons from the sun into chemical bonds that forge carbon dioxide and water into glucose, the simple sugar that is the most basic foodstuff. They can later burn this glucose as fuel or convert it into starch or fat for storage. In my case, and for most of us, the reality is that we must eat to live, usually several times a day. Not having enough food is seen as an ultimate misfortune and a cause of human suffering, and having it in abundance is cause for rejoicing. Second, eating is a major source of pleasure. In societies where food is scarce, it is seen primarily as a necessity of life, and little thought is given to it beyond that. In societies where food is abundant, people use it for purposes far beyond mere survival. In our society, a great deal of time, energy, and money go into the preparation and consumption of food that is intended to provide pleasure. Gastronomic pleasure is complex, however. We respond not only to the odors, tastes, and textures of food, but to its associations. Think of the comfort foods you would turn to if you were sick, hurt, or sad. Would you choose a baked potato, buttered toast, a steak, ice cream? Do you associate comfort with foods that a caring parent brought you when you were sick in childhood? Chicken soup or rice pudding, for example? The appearance and smell of such food combines with its taste and feel in the mouth to create a pleasurable experience that also includes satisfaction at being nourished. Psychologists describe food as a primary reinforcer, that is, something with intrinsic power to shape behavior. Give an animal food when it exhibits a certain behavior, and it will behave that way more frequently. Food is an especially powerful reinforcer, used by trainers to elicit performances of animals in circuses and movies in apparent contrast to their wild natures. In order for food to exert this effect, it must be presented to an animal that is hungry. In other words, a state of relative deprivation of the reinforcing stimulus must exist for it to exert its power over behavior. If an animal is sated, it is in a refractory state, not responsive to the reinforcing stimulus of food. Although eating acts as a primary reinforcer for everyone who is hungry, individuals derive various degrees of pleasure from it. For some, eating is mostly a necessity of life. Attention paid to the sensual aspect of food is minimal, and pleasure is sought elsewhere, in listening to music or in sex, for example. Nonetheless, I think it is fair to say that food is an important source of pleasure for most of us, and a primary source of it for some of us. For that reason, any recommendations for healthy eating that diminish or eliminate the pleasure of the experience of eating are certain to fail. Third, food that is healthy and food that gives pleasure are not mutually exclusive. A common lament I hear from patients is, "Everything I like to eat is bad for me." This is often paired with a question. If it's bad for you, why does it taste so good? Actually, as I will soon explain, there are perfectly good reasons why our senses guide us to foods high in fat and sugar, to large portions of meat, to fast food, and to what even those who love it characterize as junk food. The fault is not with our taste, but in the way we have changed the environment to make once scarce foods readily available. A more puzzling question is, why is healthy food so dull? I have my own answer to that one, which is that many people who preach the virtues of healthy eating do not really like food, or more precisely, are not the people who are neurochemically programmed to derive significant pleasure from the experience of eating. Many writers of diet books are in this category, as are many nutritionists, dietitians, and health professionals who tell others how they should eat. They are not lovers of good food. Consider this recipe for Sun Garden Burgers from a book of simple recipes for living well. Combine carrot pulp, ground flax and sunflower seeds, finely minced celery, onion, parsley, and red pepper. Season with soy sauce, shape into patties, and leave them in the sun until warm, or place in warm oven for 15 minutes. These are delicious served in a cabbage leaf bun. Fold a cabbage leaf over the burger with any condiments you like, or cut two squares of cabbage from the large leaves and place the burger in between them. I rest my case. I like food. I experience pleasure from eating, and I am unwilling to sacrifice that experience in a quest for better health. I have spent years studying the medical literature on nutrition, working with patients who need to improve their diets, exploring the cuisines of other cultures, and testing and devising recipes that conform to healthy guidelines. My conviction is that healthy food and delicious food are not mutually exclusive. The concept of eating well must embrace both the health-promoting and pleasure-giving aspects of food. This is the most important assumption underlying the philosophy of this program. If you have had dreadful encounters with health food, if it has given you gas or worse, I can assure you that I will show you how to change your diet in ways that will move you toward optimum health and longevity without your having to give up everything you like to eat. Fourth, eating is an important focus of social interaction. Coming together to share food is a behavioral pattern we have in common with many other creatures. The word companion derives from the Latin word for bread, panis. Breaking bread together both establishes and symbolizes a fundamental social bond. A Japanese phrase for an intimate companion is one who eats rice from the same bowl. Think of the elaborate rituals of communal eating that have evolved from the simple act of sharing the most basic foodstuffs. Think of the service industries that have developed to provide us with power breakfasts, business lunches, and romantic dinners. Consider the communal feasts that punctuate the calendars of the world's religions. The social importance of food and eating, like their association with pleasure, must be honored by anyone advocating eating well. Too often, people who follow rigid diets in the name of health isolate themselves from the social interaction that is itself an important factor in optimum health. Fifth, how we eat reflects and defines our personal and cultural identity. On Thursday nights, people throughout Sweden sit down to the same meal, beginning with a thick soup made from yellow split peas. They take pleasure and comfort both in the food and in the knowledge that they are joining their countrymen and women in a national ritual that transcends both space and time. Their grandparents and great-grandparents ate this weekly meal as well. Eating particular foods thus helps define identity and membership in ethnic and national groups and in family. Ritual meals featuring special foods help renew bonds between friends, family members, and communities on both sacred and secular feast days. Consider the Jewish Passover Seder, where those in attendance ask and answer questions about the special items on the menu. Why on this night do we eat only unleavened bread, when on all other nights we eat either leavened or unleavened bread? The answer reminds the diners of their distant ancestors who labored as slaves in Egypt and had to flee so quickly that they could not allow the dough for their bread to rise. A delicious spread, haroset, made of finely chopped walnuts and apples moistened with sweet wine and often flavored with cinnamon, only appears at the Seder. It symbolizes the mortar used by the enslaved Israelites to construct the Pharaoh's buildings. Participants eat some of it spread on matzah with a topping of pungent horseradish, sometimes so pungent that it brings tears to the eyes. This combination, said to be the invention of Rabbi Hillel, a great Jewish sage who lived around the time of Jesus, is supposed to remind those who eat it of the inseparability of sweetness and bitterness, of joy and sorrow in human life. Of course, identity, defined and secured by food and eating habits, has as much to do with forbidden and disliked foods as with those that are enjoyed and promoted. Orthodox Jews will not eat pork. Orthodox Hindus will not eat meat. Orthodox Muslims do not consume alcohol. Food taboos are common, sometimes elaborate, and oftentimes genuine attempts to connect to and respect religious beliefs and traditions. On the other hand, some food taboos seem ridiculous, and the taboos of one group may strike another group as most peculiar, emphasizing the otherness of those who refuse to eat fish, fowl, garlic, or sugar, for example. And so identity is further strengthened by defining oneself and one's culture or social group as different through eating or not eating what other people eat. The power of food to define social and cultural identity may also depend on particular ingredients, combinations of ingredients, or preparations that provide instantly recognizable textures, flavors, and aromas. The steamed rice of Japan that sticks together and has a subtle earthy flavor is nothing like the steamed rice of India, whose grains are separate, drier, and more aromatic. Poi, the sour, pasty staple made from taro root, is a unique food of Hawaii and related cultures of Oceania. Lemongrass, chili, mint, and garlic occur together only in the cuisines of Southeast Asia. Olive oil, tomatoes, garlic, and basil create a signature flavor of the cooking of southern Italy, while olive oil, lemon juice, garlic, mint, and cumin in combination announce the Middle Eastern origin of a dish. And tomato, peanuts, and chili are a characteristic flavor principle of West African cuisine. Often, it is these culture-specific tastes, odors, and textures that people long for when they have left their native lands, and that occasion such joy when people reconnect with them. The French pine for their excellent bread when they travel in other countries, Indians for their curries, Japanese for their rice. And often, when people have abandoned their traditional foods, whether by choice or by circumstance, they will seek them out again when they are sick or otherwise in need. For example, I am told that it is common for Japanese who have long eaten Western diets to come back to meals of fish, rice, vegetables, and miso soup in their old age. Perhaps their digestive systems are better adapted to these dishes, or perhaps the associations of the foods, their reinforcing of cultural identity, is comforting. There is a great deal of psychological, social, and cultural investment in what we eat, and unless this aspect of food is acknowledged, change will not be possible. Eating well means, among other things, not rejecting or giving up the characteristics of cuisine that help define oneself or one's society, but rather adapting them to conform to dietary principles that promote optimum health. Sixth, how we eat is one determinant of health. I have already indicated my belief that just as the quality of fuel influences the performance and longevity of an internal combustion engine, so the quality of food we eat must influence the life and health of the body. The question is how great that influence is relative to other factors. In the heading, How We Eat is One Determinant of Health, I want to emphasize the word one. The determinants of health are myriad, starting with genetics and including a great many environmental, psychosocial, and spiritual factors. Diet is only one aspect of lifestyle, and lifestyle is only one set of variables in the mix. It is probably not possible to isolate from this complexity any one element and specify its exact contribution to health. Certainly, it is false to claim, as some do, that diet is the sole or most important determinant of health, or as the cliché says, we are what we eat. Nevertheless, it is possible to get an idea of the influence of diet by looking at the effects of dietary change in large populations, and through epidemiology, the study of the incidence and frequency of diseases in populations. For example, during World War II, deaths from heart attacks dropped precipitously in Denmark, Holland, and other occupied countries of Western Europe when popular foods high in saturated fat, butter, cheese, and meat especially, became scarce or unobtainable. When those foods reappeared on tables after the war, deaths from heart attacks rose to previous rates. Japanese women on traditional diets have one of the lowest rates of breast cancer in the world, but when they move to America and eat like Americans, their breast cancer rate quickly rises. Japanese men on traditional diets have low rates of prostate cancer compared to American men, and when they do get it, their tumors behave much less aggressively than those of Americans. At present, Japan and China are both in the midst of sweeping dietary change, in which traditional patterns of eating are weakening in the face of shifts to Western diets, with greatly increased consumption of beef, dairy products, and even American-type fast food. Already, rates of Western diseases like atherosclerosis and coronary heart disease, once rare in East Asia, are rising. These countries are living laboratories in which we are able to observe correlations between changes in diet and changes in health. Similarly, subgroups with different eating habits may have very different health problems from the larger societies in which they live. Studies of Seventh-day Adventists in America, a vegetarian Christian sect, show them to have much lower rates of cardiovascular disease than other Americans. Still, the exact contribution of vegetarianism to this difference is not clear, because Seventh-day Adventists also do not smoke or drink alcohol, and they enjoy the psychosocial support of a cohesive community that many other Americans lack. Diet has special significance among lifestyle factors in that people have total control over it, at least potentially. You cannot change your genes, control the quality of the air you breathe all the time, or avoid the stresses of everyday life, but you can decide what to eat and what not to eat. even if you were stuck on occasion in an institutional cafeteria. It is a shame not to take advantage of that control by making wise choices from what is available and by informing yourself about wise and unwise choices of food. My conclusion is that diet is an important influence on health, one that you can control to a greater degree than other factors, and that eating a good diet does not excuse you from attending to other aspects of lifestyle if you want to enjoy optimum health. Seventh, changing how we eat is one strategy for managing disease and restoring health. In the 5th century BC, Hippocrates, the godfather of Western medicine, advised people to let food be your medicine and medicine be your food. This idea is not much in fashion in the West today, but it is strikingly current in Asia. In both India and China, for example, highly developed systems of healing and cuisine are intertwined. Dietary modification is a primary therapeutic intervention in Ayurvedic medicine, as well as in traditional Chinese medicine, and in both Indian and Chinese cooking, ingredients are valued for their health-promoting properties as much as for their flavors. Ginger, popular in both cultures, is esteemed by Chinese cooks for its ability to neutralize noxious qualities of flesh foods and to stimulate the stomach, and by Indian cooks for its warming and gas-dispelling effects. Its medicinal virtues, ginger is a powerful anti-inflammatory agent as well as an excellent remedy for stomach upset, are just being rediscovered by Westerners. Turmeric, responsible for the yellow color of curries, is another effective anti-inflammatory herb, prized by Indians for its healing properties at least as much as for its taste and color. An extract of it, called curcumin, is now available in capsules in health food stores here, and people are taking it for the treatment of arthritis and other inflammatory disorders. At the University of Arizona's Integrative Medicine Clinic, our doctors routinely ask patients to change their diets, to eliminate some foods and add others, as one strategy for managing their conditions. Just as diet is only one factor influencing health, so dietary change is only one therapeutic approach, never recommended in isolation. Our patients also get prescriptions for exercise, relaxation training, dietary supplements, and botanical remedies, as well as referrals to both conventional and alternative practitioners for further diagnostic evaluations and treatments. When they get better, we cannot specify the exact contribution of dietary change to the favorable outcome, but often we regard it as significant. Recently, I saw a 70-year-old woman with lifelong asthma who had access to the best conventional medical care in the country and was dependent on a great deal of suppressive and toxic medication. She had an exemplary lifestyle and wanted to know if integrative medicine had anything to offer her. Her dietary history revealed high consumption of dairy products, and when I asked about this, she told me she had grown up on a farm in Wisconsin, had always loved milk, cheese, and yogurt, and had never been told that milk could aggravate asthma. I also discovered that she had a strongly allergic history, including infantile eczema, often a sign of milk intolerance. At the top of my list of recommendations to her, I wrote, "Eliminate all milk and milk products from your diet. You can substitute soy or rice milk, non-dairy frozen desserts, cheese substitutes made from soy or almonds." The patient knew this was going to be a challenge. "Those are my main foods," she said. Nevertheless, she made the adjustment, and although I told her not to expect to see the full effect of this change for 2 months, she noted improvement after only a few weeks, and subsequently had one of her best winters ever, winter usually being her worst time of year. She found it incredible that no doctor in all the years she had sought medical attention had made this dietary suggestion to her. This therapeutic approach is an example of nutritional medicine, a subject not currently taught in medical schools, one central to the integrative medicine that I promote, and one sure to come into its own in coming years because it opens so many therapeutic possibilities with little or none of the toxicity associated with pharmaceutical drugs. It is my hope that doctors of the future will begin to honor the wisdom of the past and once again use food as medicine. Throughout the Western world for at least the past 3 decades, people have heard that fat is bad for you and have turned to low-fat and non-fat versions of prepared foods. Food manufacturers have learned that the words low-fat and non-fat on labels sell their products. Doctors, nurses, nutritionists, and dietitians all advise cutting fat intake to reduce risks of heart disease and cancer, to lose weight, and to live longer. High-fat foods like butter, cheese, fatty meats, and fish, nuts, avocados, and rich desserts are now on the no list because of their perceived ill effects on health and longevity. But as might be expected, their very forbidden nature increases their attractiveness for many. At the same time, increasing numbers of people have fallen under the spell of a quite different message about diet and health, that carbohydrates, not fat, are the root of all evil, the cause of obesity, high blood pressure, heart disease, deficiency of energy, and feeling low. Low-carbohydrate diets, based on this idea, some of which encourage people to eat all the meat, butter, cream, and cheese they want, have become very popular, and their promoters' books are perennial bestsellers. The Atkins diet, developed by New York cardiologist Robert Atkins, M.D., over 25 years ago, and now enjoying a resurgence, is the best-known version in the U.S. In Europe, its equivalent is the Montagnac diet, the invention of a Frenchman, Michel Montagnac, a non-physician who worked as the personnel director of a pharmaceutical company before he embarked on his current career of diet guru. A decade ago, when Montagnac first published his ideas, the French medical establishment denounced the diet as a passport to a heart attack. Atkins has been the target of similar scorn from doctors in America, especially from those who advocate extremely low-fat diets. The Pritikin Institute, brainchild of the late entrepreneur Nathan Pritikin, puts people with high blood pressure, heart disease, adult-onset diabetes, and other chronic diseases on diets with no more than 10% of total calories as fat, and gets many good results. Pritikin meals emphasize grains, including bread and pasta, vegetables, fruits, and moderate amounts of low-fat preparations of fish and chicken. The Institute teaches that fat is the root of all evil, and that the ideas of Atkins and Montagnac are dangerous. Dean Ornish, M.D., the California cardiologist who has demonstrated reversal of coronary heart disease on a program of very low-fat vegetarian food, stress reduction, and group support, calls Dr. Atkins irresponsible. It's a great way to sell books to tell people that steaks and eggs are health foods, but they're not, he says. He further contends, as do conventional dietitians, that most of the weight loss on a low-carbohydrate, high-fat diet is water, due to a diuretic effect of altered metabolism. That's ridiculous, Atkins retorts. When obese patients lose 100 or more pounds on the Atkins diet, as many do, you're going to tell me that's water? I'm glad Dr. Ornish makes that statement because it will encourage people to question his credibility. Such is the contentiousness that divides the camps. And since both sides can cite published studies supporting their positions, it is not easy for people to decide between them. So what is it to be? A life with no butter, cheese, oil, and meat? Or one with no sugar, bread, potatoes, and pasta? A plant-based diet that minimizes or avoids consumption of meat and animal products? Or a carnivorous free-for-all that protects health by focusing on the right fats and the right carbohydrates? Fats and carbohydrates are two of the three categories of macronutrients, that is to say, the big foods that our bodies need. The third is protein. These large groupings of foods supply all of the body's caloric or energy needs. In addition, protein gives it structural elements for growth and repair of tissue. The body also needs other substances to function normally, but in much smaller amounts, vitamins and minerals, for example, and a variety of protective compounds in plants that bolster the body's defenses against the many hazards of living. The term micronutrients, little foods, refers to all those latter elements of diet. In this section, I want to explain what we know about macronutrients from scientific research with a view towards specifying their place in the optimum diet. I will examine the roles of fats, carbohydrates, and proteins in human health and nutrition to see if there are answers to the kinds of disagreements I have just sketched, and whether decisions about the macronutrients can be reconciled with the seven principles of diet and health I've already discussed. There are very important questions about how much and what kinds of the big foods we should eat to maintain optimum health. And although the scientific data is not conclusive, indications are that many prevailing ideas of conventional nutritionists are wrong. In fact, many listeners may be surprised by what I have to say, because I believe that some conventional ideas have influenced both popular and medical thinking for the worse, and have spawned styles of cuisine and food preparation that may not be good for us. Obviously, we still have much to learn about human nutrition and the influence of diet on health. Neither doctors nor dietitians have all the answers, and on some questions the experts disagree sharply. I am not afraid to speculate or to try to make good guesses as I venture into unknown territory, but I will always base my speculations on the best available scientific evidence as well as common sense. Many patients who ask doctors what they should eat to reduce disease risks or treat existing ailments are told, "It doesn't matter, just eat a balanced diet." The general public is well aware that most doctors are essentially uneducated about nutrition. Medical educators object when critics confront them with that fact, pointing out that first-year students receive intensive instruction in biochemistry. But while it is true that nutritional science starts with knowledge of basic biochemistry, it is also true that knowing biochemistry is in no way equivalent to understanding nutrition, let alone to knowing what an optimum diet is or how to advise patients about making dietary changes to improve health. In order to write about macronutrients, I reviewed a weighty biochemistry text currently being used in medical schools. Biochemistry is a daunting subject, the biggest hurdle first-year medical students have to jump, since it involves rote memorization of the complex details of a great many chemical reactions that take place in living organisms. Students promptly forget these details once their exams are over. The Krebs cycle, named for German biochemist and later Oxford professor Sir Hans Adolf Krebs, is the central hub of metabolic reactions that generate most of the energy derived from food. I know hardly any physicians who remember the correct sequence of conversions it comprises. Yet the teaching of biochemistry that produces this result often passes for nutritional instruction in medical schools. Biochemistry provides a scientific basis for understanding why essential fatty acids, those the body needs but cannot make, and therefore must be supplied by diet, are necessary. But if that information is buried in a mass of confusing and irrelevant detail, medical students are going to forget it just as quickly as they forget the Krebs cycle once they pass their tests. They are not going to be able to use it in attending to their own diets or advising patients how to improve theirs. Recently, I asked a class of second-year medical students, their first-year biochemistry experience under their belts, what they knew of one group of essential fatty acids, the omega-3s. These are the unusual fatty acids found in a limited number of foods, mainly oily cold-water fish and a few seeds and nuts. The students remembered hearing about omega-3 fatty acids in biochemistry, and a few thought they remembered their chemical structure, but none could tell me their nutritional significance or health benefits. In fact, these fats remain fluid at low temperatures and give vital flexibility to cell membranes. They are also the compounds from which the body makes hormones that keep blood from clotting abnormally and inflammation from getting out of hand. The absolute requirement of omega-3s in sufficient daily amounts for good nutrition should be a great concern of doctors who advocate very low-fat diets. Most people in Western industrialized countries are already eating diets deficient in essential fatty acids in general and omega-3 fatty acids in particular. If they now avoid fatty foods in the belief that dietary fat is the chief cause of obesity and illness, this deficiency is likely to become even greater. Ornish, who only recently began recommending that people take supplemental capsules of oils containing omega-3 fatty acids, has said, "You might say, well, why not eat fish, because then you can get the fish oil directly from the fish. And you can. The problem is that the fish that are the highest in the omega-3 fatty acids, salmon and other deep water fish, are also the highest in fat and cholesterol. This is a problem only if you consider all fat bad. Salmon is a delicious fish, and its natural oiliness lends it to preparation without added fat, as by steaming, poaching, broiling, or grilling. If you urge people to avoid salmon because of its natural fat content, you encourage them to shun an excellent source of vital nutrients that are hard to find elsewhere. Many doctors who once learned about essential fatty acids to pass biochemistry exams now have no working knowledge of them, and so do not see the danger of the very low-fat diets that are popular at spas, clinics, and cardiac rehabilitation centers. Biochemistry instruction also does not often include or fails to place proper emphasis on information of great nutritional significance. For years, dietitians have taught people to distinguish between simple carbohydrates, sugars, and complex carbohydrates, starches, and to moderate consumption of the former while increasing intake of the latter. Physicians often pass this information on to patients, but it turns out to be a meaningless distinction and bad advice. What counts, as I will explain in more detail shortly, is how fast a particular carbohydrate food turns into glucose and raises levels of blood sugar, a characteristic expressed numerically as the glycemic index. In general, high glycemic index foods stress the pancreas, and in many people promote weight gain and unhealthy distribution of fats in the blood and tissues. Some complex carbohydrates, potatoes for instance, have a higher glycemic index and thus raise blood sugar faster than some simple ones like table sugar. Such differences influence the short and long-term effects of these foods on our energy and health. But the biochemistry text I read barely mentioned glycemic index. So it is not surprising that most physicians are unfamiliar with the concept, let alone with how to use it when counseling patients about diet in general and carbohydrate foods in particular. Here are the big questions I have about the big foods. What are the proportions of fat, carbohydrate, and protein in an ideal diet? Should you change these proportions if you want to lose or gain weight? Are there better and worse carbohydrates? Which carbohydrate food should predominate in an ideal diet? Are there better and worse fats? What are the proportions of different kinds of fat in an ideal diet? Are there better and worse sources of protein? What protein foods should predominate in an ideal diet? In order to answer these questions, I would like to help you understand how the body uses carbohydrate, fat, and protein, how it derives energy from them, stores them, and interconverts them one into another. In this discussion, I will try not to burden you with more than the minimum amount of biochemical detail necessary to understand the roles of the macronutrients in maintaining life and health. I mentioned earlier that all nutritional energy, what we measure as calories, originates as solar energy that has been captured and stored by green plants. Plants accomplish this feat through photosynthesis, using the energy of light from the red and blue ends of the spectrum to bind carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and water from the earth into molecules of glucose, releasing oxygen in the process. Glucose, also called dextrose, grape sugar in plants, and blood sugar in animals, is one of the simplest carbohydrates and the most basic food for cells of both plants and animals. It is the fuel that many cells prefer to use in order to obtain energy. When the sun goes down, photosynthesis stops in plants, and the cellular machinery focuses on reversing those reactions. In the reverse process, called respiration, cells burn or metabolize newly minted glucose by combining it with oxygen to break the molecule down to carbon dioxide and water and capture the energy that was stored in its chemical bonds. You can burn pure crystalline glucose in a test tube and watch it give off heat and light. Cellular respiration is a multi-step process of controlled burning, the last steps being the famous and forgettable Krebs cycle that generates usable energy in the form of a simple compound called ATP, adenosine triphosphate. ATP is the metabolic currency of all cells, holding most of its energy in the chemical bond linking the phosphate group to the rest of the molecule. Active tissues of both plants and animals need large, constant amounts of glucose and have elaborate hormonal controls to regulate the distribution and fate of this simple sugar and its content of solar energy. The metabolism of glucose is disturbed in obesity and in diabetes, though which is cause and which is effect is not clear. If blood glucose drops too low, as can happen if a person with diabetes injects too much insulin or eats too little, fatigue and weakness develop rapidly, followed by unconsciousness, symptoms that disappear in seconds following an intravenous injection of a glucose solution. The brain is just that dependent on a constant, steady supply of glucose. It also requires a disproportionate share of the body's total metabolic energy, and so is a major consumer of glucose in the blood. Carbohydrates are compounds made up of carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen, arranged in ring structures that can be linked together end to end to form more complex molecules. The simplest carbohydrates are single-ring sugars, glucose, fructose or fruit sugar, and galactose, a milk sugar, collectively called monosaccharides, meaning sugars composed of one ring. Two of these rings linked together make disaccharides, such as maltose, produced by sprouting grains and abundant in beer. Sugarcane plants and sugar beets make quantities of another very familiar disaccharide called sucrose, or table sugar. Lactose, the main sugar in milk, is also a disaccharide. Sugars are osmotically active, meaning they draw water molecules toward themselves through porous membranes like those enclosing cells. This property makes it impossible for plants and animals to store energy in the form of sugars. If too much glucose were to accumulate in a cell, the cell would quickly swell and burst. Therefore, to store energy, organisms must convert the glucose they make into something else. Plants often turn sugars into starches, much larger carbohydrate molecules of different chemical structure that do not draw water across cell membranes and so are convenient for storing energy for later use. The commonest storage sites for starch are roots, as in sweet potatoes, underground stems, white potatoes, fruits, winter squashes, and seeds, beans and grains. There are two principal plant starches, amylose and amylopectin. Amylose consists of long chains of glucose rings strung together like single tight strands of beads. In amylopectin, the chains have many side branches. When we eat starchy vegetables, fruits, and grains, our bodies turn these complex carbohydrates back into glucose for metabolic fuel. But the different structural characteristics of amylose and amylopectin affect the speed of this conversion. Amylopectin being much easier to digest because its branches offer more surfaces for enzymes to work on. This difference is important because it is a major determinant of glycemic index, of how fast various starchy foods affect our blood sugar levels, which in turn affects our energy, our tendency to gain weight, and our general health. The main form of starch in the sticky white rice that Japanese and Chinese people steam and eat as a staple carbohydrate with most meals is amylopectin. Steamed white basmati rice, a staple grain of India, looks and tastes quite different with drier separate grains because its starch is mostly amylose. Diet gurus who warn people away from white rice as a refined carbohydrate that wreaks havoc with blood sugar ignore this difference. Even if you are carbohydrate sensitive, you can enjoy some white rice if you choose a lower glycemic index variety like basmati. Animals can turn glucose into their own form of starch called glycogen and store it in the liver and muscles as a short-term energy reserve. Glycogen, like amylopectin, is highly branched, making for rapid conversion to glucose. If you stop eating or stop eating carbohydrates, you have enough glycogen in the liver to maintain blood glucose for about 48 hours if you are sedentary, less if you are active. Exercise vigorously and your glycogen supply will run out quickly. After it does, your body will have to find another source of glucose for metabolic fuel. Endurance athletes like marathon runners know this point well and call it hitting the wall. It represents the lag time between using up the last of the glycogen and shifting metabolism into another mode to burn protein and fat instead. Athletes say it feels like an overwhelming drop in available energy, and to gain time before it happens, they often indulge in carbohydrate loading before events, eating large quantities of pasta, for example, in order to maximize glycogen stores. Plants and animals can condense energy further by turning glucose into fats, our second macronutrient, for even longer-term storage. Fats are mixtures of fatty acids, chains of carbon atoms linked together, most of them attached to hydrogen atoms, with a distinctive oxygen-containing group at one end of the chain, the weakly acid end. The carbon-carbon bonds in fatty acids are more energetic than those in carbohydrates. As a result, fats have almost twice the calories of carbohydrates gram for gram. Oils are liquid fats. The term lipids includes all of these substances, fats, oils, their constituent fatty acids, and more complex compounds built from them. Plants often store oils in seeds, only rarely in fruits, and almost never in any quantity elsewhere. Their purpose in seeds is to provide concentrated energy for the growing embryo of the next generation. We store fat under the skin, in all the familiar places, as energy reserves in anticipation of hard times, as well as to insulate the body and cushion vital organs. We also make fat easily from glucose, so that any food that can be broken down to glucose can also be converted to fat. When caloric intake exceeds expenditures, the body will store the excess as fat. Conversely, whenever caloric expenditures exceed intake, and liver and muscle glycogen is exhausted, fat reserves are mobilized for metabolism. Stored fat cannot be converted to energy as quickly or as easily as glycogen can, one reason for the phenomenon of hitting the wall. To obtain energy from fat, the body breaks down fatty acid molecules into two carbon fragments, called acetate fragments, that cells can burn in their metabolic furnaces, combining them with oxygen and producing carbon dioxide and water as waste products. Most, but not all, cells can carry out this process called fatty acid oxidation. Muscle is particularly good at it, so when muscle cells run out of glycogen, they begin getting energy from fatty acids. During prolonged fasting, most tissues use fatty acids as fuel, but some cannot. Brain cells, in particular, cannot get their energy needs from fatty acids. They can, however, burn some of the intermediate breakdown products of fatty acids that the liver releases into the bloodstream when it burns fats. These molecules, called ketone bodies, become important during starvation when they build up to sufficient levels in the blood for the brain to take them in and use them as an alternative energy source, a situation called ketosis. Remember that the highly specialized cells of the brain prefer to run on glucose, the simplest fuel. But an important fact of human nutrition is that although our bodies can easily turn glucose into fat, they cannot turn fat back into glucose. This basic biochemical limitation has profound implications for people who are starving and for dieters who restrict or eliminate intake of carbohydrates. Physicians have noted that people experiencing ketosis, when the brain is denied a source of glucose and is forced to burn ketone bodies, often report feelings of well-being and the absence of hunger. Dr. Atkins and his imitators suggest that the same situation obtains on their low-carbohydrate diets, that people following them go into ketosis and experience decreased hunger and increased mental and physical energy as a result. It is not clear that this is the case because the popular low-carbohydrate diets are very high in protein, and as I will explain shortly, the body can make glucose from protein when it is deprived of its usual sources. I think the brain can still get its usual fuel on an Atkins-Montagnac regime, but I am concerned that its method of doing so may have long-term detrimental effects on health. Fatty acids come in three varieties. In saturated fatty acids, all available carbon bonds are occupied by or saturated with hydrogen atoms. These are the fat molecules the body prefers to break down to acetate fragments and burn for energy, so it is not surprising that stored animal fat is mostly composed of saturated fatty acids. Monounsaturated fatty acids have one link in the chain where two carbon atoms share two bonds with each other instead of one. This double bond is a point of strain in the fatty acid chain that affects its shape and chemical nature. Monounsaturated fatty acids occur in the oils of many nuts and seeds, and also dominate the fatty acid profiles of olive oil and avocados. Our body fat contains monounsaturated fatty acids too, and the body can burn them for energy. Polyunsaturated fatty acids have two or more double bonds and predominate in the oils obtained from the seeds of safflowers, sunflowers, sesame, corn, and soy. The body can convert some of these into saturated fatty acids for fuel, but it has special uses for polyunsaturated fatty acids that are important to understand. It incorporates them into membranes of cells and intracellular organelles, the little organs like mitochondria and ribosomes that exist within cells, taking advantage of their flexibility and water-repelling property to hold and protect the watery contents of these structures. The body also synthesizes important hormones from polyunsaturated fatty acids, including steroid hormones and prostaglandins. I will have more to say about dietary fats and lipid metabolism, because they have important influences on health and longevity. To make the third kind of macronutrient, proteins, plants combine simple sugars with nitrogen from the air or soil to make amino acids, the building blocks of these compounds. Proteins are much larger and much more complex than carbohydrates and fats, with intricate, distinctive three-dimensional shapes, and each organism has unique proteins that establish its biological identity, in addition to others that are common among many forms of life. Protein makes up most of the weight of the human body that is not water. Animals break down the proteins they eat into their constituent amino acids, then rearrange those building blocks into the protein molecules they need for growth and repair. They can also synthesize many amino acids, but not all. For humans, 10 amino acids are essential, meaning they must be supplied by the diet in order for the body to manufacture the proteins it needs. Without them, protein deficiency and malnutrition result quickly, because the body cannot store nitrogen or amino acids in the way it can store carbohydrates and fat. Another important category of proteins is enzymes. The alchemy by which both plants and animals transform the basic product of photosynthesis, glucose, into a range of sugars, starches, fats, and proteins depends on enzymes, specialized protein molecules that control biochemical reactions. Enzymes can turn sugars into starches, starches into glucose, sugars into fats, fats into acetate fragments for fuel, acetate fragments into cholesterol, sugars into proteins, and proteins back into sugars, depending on the organism's needs. Many of these conversions are the same in plants and animals, the main differences being that plants can make glucose from carbon dioxide, water, and sunlight, and can make amino acids and proteins from scratch using nitrogen from the soil. Enzymes are responsible for all of these reactions. One more category of proteins in the body is receptors. Like enzymes, these are molecules designed to bind other molecules in specific ways, but rather than speeding up biochemical reactions, their function is to carry information between and within cells. Many receptors exist within the lipid membranes that enclose cells. For example, insulin receptors are present on the surfaces of most cells. When the pancreas secretes the hormone insulin into the blood, it binds to insulin receptors, and the change in the conformation of the receptor initiates other changes in the cell that allow glucose to pass into the cell and enter into oxidation reactions to produce energy. Deficiency or loss of insulin receptors is the biochemical correlate of insulin resistance, which in its extreme form is the immediate cause of adult-onset diabetes, also called type 2 and non-insulin-dependent diabetes. In this disease, the pancreas makes insulin, but cells cannot respond to it. Their sensitivity to insulin is diminished. As a result, blood sugar is persistently elevated, and the whole energy economy of the body is deranged. This is not an exhaustive catalog of uses of proteins in the body, but I think it contains a sense of their key roles in maintaining life. It is also important to know that if the diet supplies more protein than the body needs to build, maintain, and repair itself, the excess goes into the metabolic furnace for fuel. Digestion breaks dietary protein into its constituent amino acids, and many of the amino acids are easily turned into glucose, which can be burned, turned into glycogen, or converted to fat for storage depending on energy needs. You must also know that the metabolism of protein as an energy source is quite different from that of fat and carbohydrates because of protein's nitrogen content. Fat and carbohydrates are clean-burning fuels, releasing only carbon dioxide and water as the final byproducts of oxidation. Protein, in addition, leaves a residue of ammonia, a simple compound of nitrogen and hydrogen that many of us know as a household cleaning agent or a fertilizer. Ammonia is extremely toxic, especially to brain cells, and its generation in the course of oxidizing amino acid fuels creates a major problem of elimination for the body. I will speak more about this and its relevance to determining how much protein the optimum diet should contain when I return to the subject of protein later on. I mentioned earlier that while the body cannot obtain glucose from fat, it can make it from protein. Many amino acids can serve as substrates for the synthesis of glucose in the liver, a process called gluconeogenesis, Greek for creating glucose from scratch. During starvation, the brain's demand for glucose causes the body to sacrifice its own muscle tissue in order to support gluconeogenesis, so that weight loss in starvation represents not only the metabolism of stored fat, but also loss of lean body mass. The possibility that this may also happen on low-carbohydrate diets is cause for concern. Even if people on those diets are eating a lot of protein, the absence of dietary carbohydrate may still encourage the body to turn to its own muscle tissue as a source of amino acids for gluconeogenesis to feed the brain. That concludes an overview of the macronutrients. I would now like to look at each category more closely to explain their place in the optimum diet. A popular brand of cornstarch sold in America uses as its logo the image of an Indian maiden whose body is an ear of golden corn. She has been known to several generations of American housewives and has been even better known to countless earlier generations of Native Americans, for she is the corn goddess, personifying the spirit of the plant that has helped sustain human life in the New World. Corn, or maize, is unique among cereal grains in that it is wholly dependent on human intervention for its own survival. The husks that envelop an ear of corn prevent the individual grains from germinating. Corn is thus a human invention, the product of complex interbreeding of ancestral grains, greatly modified by human selection. Like other grains, maize seeds contain carbohydrate, protein, and fat. The largest fraction of their total caloric content is starch that the germinating seed can convert to glucose and burn to get the energy needed for initial growth until it produces enough young leaf to photosynthesize its own food. That Native Americans deified this plant is a statement of its importance in their world. Throughout history in the Americas, an abundant maize harvest meant health, happiness, and assurance of food through the winter. Crop failure meant starvation and untimely death. In other parts of the world, people held other cereal grains in equally high esteem, because they depended on them in the same way for health and life. In Japan, rice planting was, and still is for many, a religious act, in which people invoke the aid of Tano Kami, the Shinto god of rice paddies, to protect the plants and assure a good harvest. Tibetans are as reverent about the cultivation of barley, a grain that can be adapted to short-season areas. These crops are usually called dietary staples because they are the most basic elements of human nutrition, and products made from them, which provide most calories in the form of starch, often help define cultural identity. Think of the rice bowl in Asia, tortillas in Mexico, rye bread in Northern Europe, and wheat bread in the rest of Europe and most of North America. In our own culture, bread, usually made from refined wheat flour, is served with most meals. I suspect that our ancestors, rather than politely eating rolls with butter while waiting for first courses to arrive, tore hunks of bread off large loaves and used them to sop up sauces, gravies, and juices. In lean times, there might have been nothing to sop. Many meals might have consisted of bread alone. Bread has earned the designation staple.